You're listening to a Monorail News production. Now, get ready to step into the magic.
Hello and welcome to Magic Time by Monorail News. This week, we have a former Imagineer, a really great guy whose projects have been in the news recently for some reasons that I won't talk about. We have lead designer on Splash Mountain and lead designer on Toontown, Don Carson. Don, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well, thanks.
You know, it's funny because every time I talk to an Imagineer, the discussions usually get pretty in-depth. We can talk about all the different projects that they've done. But with you, you've done not just projects in the physical world, but also in the digital world as well. And I was just going to really start with by asking you how you got into theme park design in general.
Okay. I originally started as an illustration major back in the very early 80s. And when I graduated, realized that commercial illustration anyway was not something I necessarily wanted to do. And I started working on branching my portfolio to include things that interested me. One of the things I'd always loved was going to Disneyland as a kid. My grandmother lived in Santa Ana. And we lived in San Francisco, and we used to take trips once or twice a year and go to Disneyland. And at the time, I didn't know that Imagineering was a thing, was a job that you could do. I don't know what I was thinking, who was responsible for these attractions, but I didn't realize it was a job. But I had a love for theater, I had a love for illustration and an illustration background, and I eventually got a job as the art director for the Renaissance Pleasure Fairs in Northern and Southern California. And that mixture of both the illustration work and then also the environmental design, I'll bet, smaller budgets than certainly a Disney theme park. Toward the end of the 1980s, Disney was doing a big hiring blitz for the Disney decade. And I was lucky enough to be swept in. And that sort of mixture between my illustration background and my environmental design background was a good fit. And so I ended up starting at Imagineering in the late 80s and never looked back.
So what was your first project once you got to Imagineering that you can talk about? I don't know if it's something that, you know, that came to fruition or has been shelved. What's the first thing you did that you are free to discuss?
Well, literally the first day that I started was the five people started that same day, and we were all sitting around a table, and Kathy Kirk, who was the manager of the show design department, basically doled out all our various assignments, and I was the last one on the table. Everybody got an assignment that I thought was cooler than the last assignment, and then she finally got to me, and she said that I would be working on the Splash Mountain for Walt Disney World. And everybody's assignment seemed so incredible that when I got the third Splash Mountain, because the Tokyo Splash Mountain had already started its development, I thought, oh, that's too bad. In hindsight, all those other projects, which are all marvelous, ended up not happening. And Splash, which I was initially only hired to work on for about 2.5 weeks because of some physical changes to the ride layout from the Disneyland version. And those 2.5 weeks ended up being like 2.5 years and took me from concept all the way through opening, which was a wonderful opportunity as a designer, a better opportunity than probably a green designer like I was deserved. But I had a fabulous team, a wonderful leader in Kathy Mangum, who was the producer on that project. And because it was the third of something, it didn't have a lot of high profileness. So there wasn't a whole lot of other art directors or Imagineers who were sort of vying to work on it. So I pretty much did the work undisturbed and ended up changing pretty much everything that making the Walt Disney World version unique unto itself.
Right, because as someone who's had the opportunity to ride it on both coasts, unfortunately not in Tokyo, it is a different feel, right? Like,
right.
you know, the Disneyland versions in Critter Country and the Walt Disney World versions in Frontierland. And you could feel that in the queue. You can feel that even in the music, right? You have kind of a big band feel in California and more of a banjo country style in Walt Disney World. And whenever I tell people about this attraction who have not been to Disney Parks, they always look at me and go, why not just build the same exact thing twice? Like, why would you spend money to tweak it slightly and make it unique? And
right. That's never the initial intent. The intent is that we pick up the blueprint from one park and then go and build it at the next park, because that would be the cheaper way to go. But one of the things that often happens is between the original and the next one is they make realizations as to what does and doesn't work. And one of the things that was challenging with Disneyland's version was that it had inline seating, which meant that one person had to sit down and the other person had to sit basically in their lap. And that took an extra so many seconds to get people into the vehicle as they were adjusting themselves, that by creating a side-by-side seating, it was much faster, which meant they could dispatch vehicles faster, which meant the capacity would be higher. But what it did do, sort of unforeseen initially, was it widened the flume, which widened the egress path, which widened the scenery, but the building remained the same size. So every one of the scenes from the Disneyland version got halved by the extra width of the vehicle, hence the reason for having to redesign it. So it was designed out of necessity, not necessarily out of a desire to reimagine the attraction.
Huh. And that's something that I've always wondered, coming from Walt Disney World. You have to understand, I'm a Disney person. It was years before I ever went to a Six Flags park or, you know, anything that wasn't Disney. So to me, the idea, and I'm a Mississippi guy, Mississippi, you know, born and raised. So Florida is the option for me because it's closer. And
right. For
me, it was just a given that a log flume ride has side-by-side seating.
Right.
And then as I got older, I realized, like, oh my gosh, you know, like, I went up to Hershey Park because my dad's from Pennsylvania, and their log flume ride does not have side-by-side seating. And I'm like,
right. This
is weird. And then I go to Disneyland, and I'm like, wait, the original doesn't have side-by-side seating. So the one that is normal to me is odd everywhere else.
Yeah.
And it almost feels like you're in a boat when you're riding at Walt Disney World versus a log when you're riding in California. And I guess
Correct.
That's just because it has to be wider, you know. And I don't know if there's like a mechanical engineering difference between a log and a boat. I'm sure there is, but I don't know. But moving on from that specifically, when you designed, because Big Thunder Mountain was already there, am I right?
Mm-hmm.
And you had to
meld
the exterior and kind of marry it between those two themes so it gels nicely. And
right.
It really does. Like, awesome job. That little area back there is one of my favorite areas in the parks. And I'm kind of wondering now, with it becoming Princess and the Frog, how they're going to handle that. And I trust that they'll do a good job, but it's also a little hard to lose my favorite restroom area.
Well, you know, that was absolutely not a foregone conclusion when we were designing it. We knew that that Critter Country and its relationship to Splash Mountain was going to be a much easier transition, and it was going to be super hard to get from the southwest to sort of Louisiana in the width of a train station, basically. So we went through a lot of iterations on the things like the train station design, the trestle, and then how do we create sort of a barrier that allows for you to look to your right and see the desert and look to your left and see sort of the green south region. And our answer was the design of the train station, which it sort of lives in both worlds, but neither world. Its color palette really lends itself to Splash Mountain, but it's sort of Western design leans and nods to the Big Thunder on the right hand side. And as far as I think, you know, I'm positive that the Imagineers are going to do a splendid job in transitioning Splash to Princess and the Frog. My guess is that probably that queue area won't change that much. I don't obviously know, but the aesthetic will probably be similar. I think probably the barn might be something that might need some changing. And I think you and I spoke before that that queue area is the way it is because we didn't want to have to air condition a giant building with all that queue in it because it would have been very expensive and just the building alone would have been kind of ominous. So the greenery was a way to keep it to keep it pleasant because, I mean, when it was going to open, we knew that it might be 3 or 4 hour lines and we wanted at least these un-air conditioned people to be in a pleasant environment that didn't feel like you were in the switchbacks of a cattle run.
Right. And, you know, this is kind of a weird thing to admit, but to me, the barn, when you go into the ride, is one of my favorite queue areas probably ever because I just really like that you walk down and there's, you know, props in the bottom level. Then you round that bit and you go up the stairs and you're up in, like, the rafters.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it really accents the cool Western-style lighting fixture. Like that's not really a chandelier, but, you know, it looks Western that you wouldn't notice on the ground, but you suddenly mm-hmm. notice it when you're up. And to me, it's a minor thing, but it makes me so excited to ride the ride, to turn that corner and to go into like the cave part of the queue. Mm-hmm. And so just bravo on that. And then you moved on to work. I know you mentioned a number of things that you're not at liberty to discuss, but the other big one, the one that I was talking with Joe Cicero about, was Toontown.
Right.
And you were one of the lead designers on Toontown, particularly in the downtown area.
Mm-hmm.
Which,
unlike Splash Mountain, which was pretty much myself and then the team, Toontown was a group, sort of a village-created project. There were multiple show designers on that. And since it was a whole land, there was a lot of sort of divide and conquer. So there was Marcella Vignali, who designed the inside of Roger Rabbit Ride. There was Andrea Favilli and I, which handled the downtown area, Maggie Parr, the Gag Factory, and Hanio Masere was responsible for Minnie's House and Goofy's House. And Jim Scholl was responsible for implementing Mickey's House and then all of the stuff that happens between the inside of his house all the way back to Meet Mickey. And he was also responsible for Donald's Boat and the Chippendale's Tree.
Right. And one thing that I love about Toontown that I think most guests just walk past are all the little gags. Like you can go to mm-hmm. the electric company building. If you touch the door, you get a little shock. Or it buzzes or something. I mean, obviously, we can't really electrocute people. So,
Well, one of the things that was interesting about that project was that one of the realities of theme park design, especially something like Disneyland, which gets on average 15 million people a year, that if you let 15 million people touch something, like if one person touches the end of a table, no problem. 15 million people touch the end of a table, that table's completely destroyed. I mean, it's just the reality of that many hands touching it. So one of the secrets to designing highly themed environments is you keep a lot of the theming out of the reach of your audience. The art form is to create it so it feels like you're in it, but really there's sort of a bubble of access that's around each guest so that they can't touch or remove or harm the object. And so operations is always very, very focused on making sure that everything looks great and accessible but isn't. And in Toontown, the operations team that worked with us really decided they wanted us to touch everything. They wanted the whole place to be something you could touch. They've had to live with that since then, but That dedication is still there. So the land, like Minnie's house and Mickey's house and downtown, is just full of things that you can interact with, which is great.
You know, and I know that's the land that I think gets the most wear and tear. Like when I go look at the mice chat or before the park closed, or look at the mice chat weekly update, that would be the land where it would be like, oh no, the paint's chipping, you know?
Right.
And because so many people are touching everything.
And yeah. Well, the thing that gets the most of it is the plunger for the fireworks factory. That thing is like cast steel with like a quarter inch of enamel baked on, you know, paint. And I don't think I've ever gone there where it wasn't worn all the way through that quarter inch of enamel, just from all the sneakers that stand on it when kids step on top of it and push down the plunger. It's just the reality of that many people being able to touch something.
Right. And to me, though, Toontown was a very immersive land and still is. And kind of, in some ways, jump-started this idea of hyper-immersive lands. Right? Because it wasn't like a fantasy land where you have Toad Hall next to, you know, London with Peter Pan, and next to, you know, Sleeping Beauty or Snow White, right? It was all designed to tell one story.
Right. Well, we had the, you know, one of the things we had a luxury in was because it was technically built outside the park and it's outside the berm, you dip down underneath, and when you pop up, there's no visual anachronisms that are going to tell you that you're also sharing space with Frontierland or New Orleans Square or Main Street. You're completely in Toontown the entire time until you dip back underneath the train trestle and go back into Fantasyland.
Right. And I know that you're now planning to put Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway in the in the park there. And that's going to be great, having, you know, a third ride in that land. I'll just never forget the first time I went to Disneyland. I waited probably 3 hours for Gadget's Go Coaster. Because we made the mistake of going on like New Year's week, which is a living nightmare. And I'll be honest with you, I went back and still have not ridden Gadget's Go Coaster because I'm too traumatized by that wait in line. And of course, that wasn't your project. But I was looking at your website, and one of the most iconic things that I think everyone notices that you've done is the entrance to Roger Rabbit's cartoon spin, and how it has the cab, you know, busting out of the front of the building.
Well, one of the things you want to do, if at all possible, when you're designing a space, is to give a sense of cause and effect, that something's happened or something just happened. So like having the safe smashed in the ground and then having the broken frayed rope above it suggests that, you know, that it's not necessarily safe to be hanging around the safe factory. There aren't a whole lot of things you can have crash into things. Like one of the ones that gets overused is planes crash into things.
Yes.
But it seemed to be appropriate that a runaway cab would blow through the top floor of that attraction and stick out the front. The other factor too is that originally that ride was intended to be two stories inside, and so that's the reason why there's a balcony that exists on the second floor of the downtown. The vehicle was meant to pop out of the Electric Company through the glass factory, out again, and then through what was the gag factory. And then the realization was that as they were starting to design the interior show, the amount of ramping that would be necessary to get the vehicle from the first floor to the second floor and then back to the first floor meant that the entire attraction would be ramped. And so they decided that they would not have a two-floor attraction, but that building is actually tall enough for there to be two floors. And the steel engineering that is on that balcony was engineered and built to sustain the weight of moving vehicles on the balcony.
Oh, wow.
And so that's the reason why he's popped out the second floor, because you would have watched cars disappear from right behind there, and then it would look like that is how he stopped that, popped out of the front of the building. And then when Tokyo decided that they wanted a Toontown as well, they didn't want a new Toontown, they wanted Toontown. And so they also have a balcony for a vehicle that will never drive on it as part of the design of downtown.
Wow. Because I remember, especially now when the parks are closed, if I want my dose of Disney theme parks, I go to my Xbox and pop in the Disneyland Adventures game that was originally a Kinect yeah. game. And it's a mm-hmm. full recreation of the whole park as it was in like 2011.
Yeah, beautifully done too.
With a couple minor omissions. No Roger mm-hmm. Rabbit, no mm-hmm. Star Tours, and no mm-hmm. Indiana Jones, because at the time Disney doesn't own the complete right to those.
Right.
Right. Right. When you go to the Roger Rabbit's building, you actually they have the hole where the car comes out, but it's boarded up. which
I've forgotten that.
Which I thought was, you know, still kind of, I was wondering if you had any input on that.
No. But I thought that they did a beautiful job, especially as we're in house arrest as a planet.
Yes.
there's nothing I would love more than to be able to pop on VR goggles and wander around inside that particular model of Disneyland, because it's such a loving recreation of that park. It would really, really help ease my quarantine if I could go visit Disneyland and wander around it, even if Lenny the Cab or Benny the Cab wasn't sticking out of the front of the building.
Well, you know, and I really, this is, and this can be a nice segue into your virtual design, all of that, but I really wish Disney would continue to make those and continue to keep them updated with new additions mm-hmm. to the parks. And then they could sell DLC that's like the park as it was in 1955.
Oh, yeah. I would line up.
Yeah, they, I don't know why they haven't done that, because I don't know if the Disneyland Adventures just didn't sell well enough mm-hmm. or, you know, what that is, but that would be rife for updates.
No, I agree completely. I would love to participate in as a customer consuming that park in a virtual way.
So you left Disney in 1995. And you continued to work for them on a freelance basis.
Yeah.
Where did you go after Disney?
So, initially we mainly left Disney because we wanted to leave the LA area. Our son was born and we decided we wanted to live somewhere else. And none of the theme park companies, including Disney, could imagine working with someone who wasn't actually physically in the office. And so I just took the brave, you know, step away from your dream and go, you know, move somewhere remote. And the only thing I could think of at the time that was similar to the theme park design was the game Myst had come out in 1994. And I was really impressed with the placemaking in that game. It was unlike anything else I had seen, and it didn't involve running around shooting zombies. It was just exploration and puzzle solving. And so I thought, well, here's an industry where I could take these wonderful skills that I'd gained at Imagineering and apply them to virtual places. And I got a job in Eugene, Oregon for Dynamics, which was a subsidiary of Sierra Online. And we moved up here, or they moved us up here, and I worked for them for a year, and I did find that they specifically weren't as interested or nor enamored with Myst as I was. So I worked on some fairly traditional games and also some sort of children's educational games. And during that year, all those companies in LA who said that they couldn't imagine using me all said, yeah, we could probably use you. So I left after a year doing the video games and started my freelance career, which I did, you know, for like 20 years, working with, Disney and Universal and Muppets and Microsoft and anybody else. But because of my experience during the video games, I had this sort of hybrid career where I wasn't just doing theme park concept design. I was also doing game design. And the tools I learned to use while in game design became the tools I also used in theme park design.
Right. And when you were doing game design, did you work on any game that I might know?
No, I think most of them went directly to the sales bin at Costco. But I did work on the 3D Ultra games. When I started at Dynamics, you could only work in 256 colors, and we were just starting to do things like motion capture and using 3D models. The only dirty secret that I have is that I've never stopped being a theme park designer, so that anytime they ask me to design an interface or design any aspect of the ride, any aspect of the game, I always turned it into a theme space. So even if it was a menu, it was the outside of a factory, or it was a miniature golf course. It was always a place that I was designing that happened to also serve as the menu.
Be a menu.
Yeah.
Which I think is a lot of fun. I'm looking at your website right now, and I see you have one, and it says contraptions. Then like the interface is on like a sign.
Mm-hmm.
With arrows, yep. and all sorts of unique things, which I think is very fun. You know, I think now we're kind of moving, like, we want everything to be flat. Mm-hmm. And we're kind of moving away from skeuomorphism. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, that's right.
And we're moving, you know, like I was playing The Last of Us, and the menu went from the first game from having like the background be a place, now it's like a black wall.
Right.
You know, and to me that's a lot less fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I always prefer a place myself.
Yeah. So what kind of freelance work did you end up doing, if you can mention any of projects in particular?
And what kind of work?
Your freelance work.
Oh, freelance work. Oh, well, it was certainly, I worked extensively with Tim Delaney on the original Disney's California Adventure, specifically the boardwalk stuff. I'd say that pretty much everything we did is now Pixar stuff.
Yes.
We worked a lot. I think we probably worked for a couple of years together on that on a freelance basis. What's interesting when you're working freelance, which is a sort of a double-edged sword, because when you're in-house, you participate at the beginning of a project, and then you expand out into the various phases of production, and if you're lucky, actually right into construction. When you're a freelancer, you're pretty much brought in as a concept artist to produce those initial sketches, and then you're not really invited to participate later on the rest of it. So you're like kind of the last guy to find out how it came out. So you look on the internet to see pictures of the finished results to see whether any of your designs actually made it into the finished product. But I worked on so just tons of stuff. I worked a lot with Chris Beatty and John Georges on some big projects, some I can and can't talk about. One of them I can talk about is I did the initial concept designs for Storybook Circus, which was a lot of fun. That took about a summer. And then I think it's a small little corner of New Fantasyland in Walt Disney World, but I'm really proud of the way the team ended up doing the graphic design for it. I think it's really charming. It has all the sort of magic of the circus without the sort of tawdriness that can also come, or scariness that can come from sort of a temporary circus being popped up. But I also worked on the very, very first concept models for Avatar before I even knew what park it was going in. Then some of my favorite, but just early, early stuff. Then I also worked with the ride department, which is actually some of my favorite work. The concept group and then the show and ride departments are separated by different buildings in most cases at Imagineering. And so you have two very different cultures. So as a concept designer or a show designer, when you're coming up with new attractions, you tend to kind of lean on things you know. So you'll say, hey, let's do a new ride. What should it be? Well, it needs this capacity. How about an Omnimover? Or how about a Flume ride? Or, you know, how about a roller coaster? And then the ride division are coming up with some really amazing new potential ride systems, but their means for communicating what those new ride systems are can be CAD drawings or blueprints or schematics, which don't necessarily speak readily to the creative department.
Right.
So the show ride department actually had me do a whole series of fake attractions that were designed around these new ride systems. And that was super fun. In fact, some of those rides actually got patented, although the ride systems didn't end up getting used. So there was rides based on Princess and the Frog, rides based on Monsters, Inc., and rides even made up on Captain Nemo and things that we all knew weren't rides that we were suggesting would get built. But these illustrations, and often these bird's eye illustrations, which I did a lot of back then, were sort of take the roof off the attraction so you could communicate to the creative folks what the capabilities of the ride system was.
Right. And what really fascinates me, because I would love to go in to talk a little bit about DCA, and especially DCA. And then one more question, but I think I'll ask this question first before I make you reckon for DCA. very friendly. No, but what is the line of things you can talk about and can't talk about? Because you'll hear Tony Baxter talk about projects like the Wizard of Oz, Concept Land, Frontierland, and Discovery Land. Or not Discovery Land, I'm sorry, Discovery Bay, or whatever that was called. I know
right.
That's Tony. So how does Disney decide what you can and can't talk about?
Well, one of the sort of realities of this business is that pretty much everything that you do is done under a non-disclosure agreement.
Right.
So a lot of my career is in drawers, never to be seen by anyone ever, with the exception of maybe they'll open that drawer at some point and look. So there are things that we just absolutely cannot talk about. Things that get built can be talked about. And depending on the project, whether or not even images that you've produced, even of built things. I worked a little bit on the Harry Potter Hogsmeade attraction as a freelancer, just toward the end before they were finishing up their construction work. And that stuff just can't be seen. I could talk about the fact that I worked on it, but I can't be specific about, you know, showing drawings from it. I think probably being able to say I worked on something is okay, but getting into the nuts and bolts of showing pictures of it, not so much.
Right. I remember listening to, who was it? I can't remember the name, but they did a never built attraction series with Tony, and he went into great detail about some projects I had never heard of. So then you'll get Joe Roy to talk about Beastly Kingdom. So my question is are some things like that allowed to be talked about and others not? Is there like a giant master spreadsheet of like what, never become ideas that you can mention, and like, some that, oh no, we don't want to ever admit that we even thought about that.
I think I certainly have a mental list of things I know I shouldn't talk about and won't, but not based on a master list. I think it was just much more of having participated in that project and knowing that, we don't talk about those things. Or there are things that are still in development that, I think probably it would be safe to talk about Westcott, assuming I could remember some of the things about Westcott, but other projects, not so much. I don't know of a master list that says what you can and cannot talk about. But I do know you cannot show work of non-built things.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
As tempting as it may be to want to peek into your, if you keep them, into your design drawer, not something you can do. So,
yeah,
DCA, my one of my favorite lands at DCA was Paradise Pier. The second iteration before Pixar Pier.
Right.
When you were designing the first iteration, did you and Tim always know that it would come out the way it came out? Or was there a period when you were thinking, you know, it was going to be, you know, this super immersive, you know, pretty much what we got the second time around, right?
Well, it was a tough time, and I can say it, I think, because I believe that the iWorks Imagineering story does a really honest job of describing the disconnect between one company who, while they were producing Disney's Tokyo Disney Sea, was also working on Disney's California Adventure, and the pressures on that team to deliver something economical were tremendous, and also the high concept of it being Michael Eisner wanting to create a California park in California was without a doubt questioned by all the people who were working on it, including Tim and myself. But you rise to the occasion and you do the best you can within the parameters that you're given.
Right.
So one of the parameters was that Disney's California Adventure is not a place the Disney characters live. So there would be no Goofy, and there would be no Minnie, and there'd be no Mickey. They would be unique and specific to California. So I think the problem, or the best examples, was all the Pitch Penny Midway games were like Catalina. I think they were dolphins, and the Sideshow shirts were not Disney themed. And so we just did the best we could. And I think that although we all worried that we were delivering something that was not the rich depth that our customers were expected of us, especially in proximity to Disneyland, right across the promenade.
Right.
I think that the wave of shock that came from the audience immediately speaking their displeasure over those aspects made it hard. You know, everybody was doing the best they possibly could.
Right.
So as hard as Tim and I worked on it, and I think some really good stuff was made, and I'm proud of it. I'm equally happy that it's gone.
Really?
Well, I love some of the stuff that came in. I love the Pitch Penny things that went in. I worked on the early concepts for the Toy Story Mania when it was called Midway Mania. All of those things were great changes. And if anything has taught me that Disneyland will never be finished, it's right now. And
right.
Our current project. And it's just, the show's constantly evolving and getting better and changing. And so the fact that all that DCA original stuff is gone is just par for the course. It's just
right.
how we do things.
So was Midway Mania a concept from the beginning? Because that didn't get built for... That was like the first thing that came online as part of DCA 2.0.
Exactly. It was also, I think it opened... few months earlier in Disney Studios, didn't it?
I think so. I think remember. So.
Yeah. So it was originally sort of designed for there. And it was just the beginning of the concept when I was working on it.
Right.
So the vehicles weren't back-to-back at the time.
Yes, I've seen this art. I've seen this art, yes.
Yeah, it was more in line like a sort of a caterpillar that where each of the seats rotated.
Right.
But it came out. It's a wonderful attraction.
Oh, absolutely! So, if Disney California Adventure is supposed to be a place where Disney characters don't live, how do you explain the giant Mickey on California Screamin'?
Well, no, that didn't come right away, did it? It was a sun before. No, it was. I'm talking about when it first opened.
When it first opened, there was the.
It was a big sun. It was a big face, not Mickey.
No, not on the Ferris wheel. That was a sun, but there was the Mickey silhouette on the loop in California Screaming, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're right. you're right. All I remember is that the stuff we were working on, we were actively, it was, you know, one of your defaults is, hey, how can I work the characters and, you know, the Disney IP into this?
Right.
And the idea was we would not be doing that. I mean, I think one of the shining examples of it, and has a little bit of a story, was that Tim wanted me to design the fold out map for Mulholland Madness, and I just didn't feel up to the task. And I think a year of him asking me to work on it, and I said, you know, you really need a graphic designer. You really need someone who really can do justice to this fold out map. And the concept of the map was that the front page was Hollywood, and then the back fold that was furthest away from the entrance was the ocean. And then all the folds between it would be Mulholland's, the map of sort of a stylistic, iconic map of Mulholland Drive. But what we discovered really quickly was that there's a whole bunch of stuff to draw at the beach, and a whole bunch of stuff to draw in Hollywood, but all there's nothing but houses and trees and stuff. I mean, there's just no iconic, right. There's just no Eiffel Tower halfway to the beach from Hollywood. And so I begrudgingly did this very messy, embarrassing, rough drawing of it. And then they basically just blew that bad drawing up. So it was painful to look at. So I rejoiced when it went to Goofy, I believe, was the next his flight school after that.
Yes.
And that map art went away. Because I just, you know, I can probably in one hand tell you those things I did that I just wish I could go back and undo.
Right.
But there were other things I just loved about it. I loved the designs for the Corndog Castle, and I did the giant, I guess, in Sideshow Shirts, the one that's sort of leaning over and holding up the ceiling. And I did the Calliope for the merry-go-round, and all that stuff's gone. But I had a wonderful time working with him. He's just great to work with. And we were just did our best and tried to rise to the occasion, whether or not we had our doubts about, you know, whether or not the California park in California was the way to go.
Do you feel like the park now is once again losing its identity? Because, you know, I feel like now they're trying to put IPs into the park a lot, where it's kind of losing. DCA 2.0 was great because it gave the park a focus, right? Like the park really kind of gelled and became, you know, the best version of itself. And now, you know, they're putting Avengers in and Pixar in. You know, and I don't know. To me, it just kind of feels like the park is losing some of that, you know, stuff that it really gained in 2.0.
But, yeah, it has Cars Land in it. It has just a jewel of a land.
Oh, it does.
It's
utterly.
I mean, talk about a masterpiece in placemaking. So for me, it's worth the ticket just to go stand in there.
Oh yeah.
You know, that's just worth it. I think it's still trying to find its identity. I think there's some great attractions in there. It's kind of hard when you're standing right next to the original Disneyland park to compete. And so maybe nothing could ever compete. I'm sure Westcott would have had the same problems. It would have been a different park, but it would have been always compared to the first child.
Right. So before we go, I want to address something I saw on Twitter last night. This is a tweet from Jenny Nicholson. She is a pop culture theme park connoisseur, I guess you would say. And she tweeted this last night. Quote, old rides, Pirate, Splash, Haunted, favor loads of details to look every direction at, and modern rides, Frozen Wrath of the Resistance, have sterile, empty interiors with one large, impressive set piece you're meant to stare directly at, which leaves less of an impression. Do you think that's a fair criticism, and could you respond to that?
I think it's an observation. I think there are different ways in which to do any attraction. Definitely part of attraction design is you definitely want to design areas of interest, things that are in the spotlight, that pulls your focus. In the case of Pirates of the Caribbean, there's a rich, rich environment of sort of not in the spotlight pieces that help support the things that are in the spotlight. I think that in the case of Frozen, which I have to admit, other than ride-through videos, I have not ridden personally, they were working with the pre-existing building and track and ride system, and it had that reversing, falling backwards mechanism. And so they just made the artistic choice to have those pools of light be everything, that you're really going to pay attention to it and allow everything to fall away to darkness. Having walked the Haunted Mansion at Disneyland multiple times, you realize really quickly that the walls that the Omnimover doesn't point to are like almost unpainted drywall. I mean, there's absolutely no reason for you to theme that in any way. And yet that area, that ride feels rich in depth and has a tremendous amount of detail. But in reality, that building doesn't. It's just things in the spotlight, bits of places to focus. The fact that on something like Frozen, you can look around and pay attention to the things that aren't focused on. I don't know. I think it was just a stylistic choice as opposed to necessarily it being a trend.
Okay,
I think
yes.
If there's a trend, and I think everybody's kind of noticed it, is that animatronics are expensive and projection surfaces are less expensive.
Yes.
So even as a designer, we do run into, like, you've got, 40 animatronics too many. What can we do to tell this story? Well, let's be clever with projection surfaces. And I think that something like Rise of the Resistance does just a masterful job of doing, giving you everything. You get projection surfaces, you get visual effects, and you get full, animatronics. It's finding that balance and being careful not to feel like you're just going from one screen to the next, which I think had its day and may still. I think also the stuff that they're doing on The Mandalorian, where they're using a real-time game engine to create environments, may be a sort of an insight into what might be coming in the future, but I don't know. I don't think screens are going away, but I think attractions that depend upon them as the sole form of entertainment are probably being scrutinized harder.
Right. I just thought that was so interesting, and it was even more interesting at like 3 in the morning last night.
Right.
Somehow being tired does that to me. it is really always a treat to talk to anyone who has worked at Disney as an Imagineer, because that's like my ultimate dream job. And I'm not talented enough artistically. I'm a policy person. I study public policy. And this is like a fun hobby for me. And to get to in some ways, hear the war stories of, people who work there is the next best thing, right? Like, I look at Disney having one of their upcharge experiences at Walt Disney World is dinner with an Imagineer.
Mm-hmm.
And,
well, it's interesting because other than, like people like Tom Morris and Joel and Cicero, who had the opportunity to really make a career there. They worked for 25, 30 years at Imagineering. I was there for a relative short amount of time, and in that time I was blessed with the chance to work on a couple projects that actually went to finish, which is, you can actually have a career there and never work on something that makes it to the finished product. But I think what I gained the most from Imagineering was it was like the best education in environmental design I could possibly have had. And I think one of the things that Imagineering does internally is it deputizes its designers to think the way Walt thought about how stories are told in an environment. And when I left, and that was 25 years ago, I brought that learning to every single thing that I've worked on. And it's a shorthand that other Imagineers, even if we haven't worked together, when we work together, it's just an understanding of how a story is told in an environment, whether it's projective surfaces or animatronics, or it's a video game and I'm just doing the menus. It is trying to bring that that license to think in a story way when designing environments. That is something that I am incredibly grateful for having had the opportunity.
Yes. I just think, you know, like I know some Imagineers, so to me, they can't really sell me the upcharge dinner with an Imagineer experience because I can just call somebody. and you know, that's a privilege, right? That's not something that every Disney fan, you know, gets to do, right? Like I'm shocked. I was honestly shocked when you accepted my invitation to come on the podcast. And I'm shocked whenever someone does, right? Like, it's just pretty cool to think that people are willing to give me an hour of their time.
Well, there's another way to think of it, and that is that we love what we do, and we don't often get an opportunity to talk about it. You know, it's less about, you know, I'm actually much less interested in talking about, you know, things I worked on 30 years ago, but I'm always interested in talking about this form of entertainment and the process that we used and the people we've had the honor to work with. So when someone calls and says, "Hey, you want to come on my show and talk about something that interests you?" Yeah, I'm more than happy to do that.
Well, we're happy to be able to provide the opportunity. Thank you so much for coming on this show. Before we
Thanks
go,
for having me.
I do have to do a sponsor plug real quick.
Okay.
Let me talk to you about Instacart. Instacart really is a fantastic way for you to get groceries delivered to your house, especially now during quarantine. You select what you want from your local grocer on your phone, on the app, and then it will be delivered to you as quickly as 2 hours. It's really fantastic. Fantastic. You can follow the link in the podcast show notes to get, I believe, 15% off. Or maybe it's free delivery first time. I'm not really sure. It's a great deal, though, even if you don't have the deal. It's fantastic. You can find me at Greg Hauser on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and Monorail News on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram for all of your Disney Park news. And if you want to see more of Don's amazing artwork, not just from Disney, but from graphic design and computer, you can visit doncarsoncreative.com. It is honestly one of the most fun, the design of the website itself just is made me smile the first time I visited looking for your email address to send you an invitation to come on the show. We'll be back in another 2 weeks with something. Maybe it'll be news, because I'm sure there'll be news coming out with Walt Disney World reopening, or maybe not, with the COVID cases surging in Florida. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next week.